amongst the talk shows, my friend Harvey's all ears, especially when it comes to listening to Rich Rossi Live.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. We are quite excited about today's show. On today's show, we are going to be talking with the star of Frank and Ava, a movie about Frank Sinatra and Ava Gardner. Frank was so torn up about her, he was slitting his wrists, writing and singing this song. It's called "I'm a Fool to Want You."
I'm a fool to want you. I'm a fool to
want you. Wow, so much feeling. Knowing the backstory, as you will when you get this film, Frank and Ava, that song will even mean more to you, and you'll understand it. We'll be back with the star of the film, Rico Simonini, co-wrote the song and played Frank.
I wonder what they say. Ah, easy and keep it funny. Let's see, they say, don't forget to listen to Rich Rossi Live. So that's it. Sounds like a wise thing to do. Quick, we better find ourselves a radio. Hi ho, Rich Rossi Live, and away!
Welcome back to Richard Rossi Live. And Frank and Ava, it's a new film. My wife and I really enjoyed it. And we're here with the star who played Frank and co-wrote the film. Can you hear us okay, Rico?
Yeah, I hear you great there, Richard.
Okay, Rico. Were you a Sinatra fan growing up, or was it the play? I know you did this first as a play, and our mutual friend Marty Ingalls, the comic who you was one of the people you dedicated the film to in memoriam, had told me when you were doing the play. Was the play your first immersion into Frank's world, or were you a big fan prior, Rico?
Well, as an Italian growing up in New York, I think Sinatra's part of your DNA, whether you want it or not. I mean, I used to work at Italian restaurants in Brooklyn, New York, and Sinatra's was on the jukebox. But even more than that, my dad used to hang around with those guys, the 21
wow.
Club and all these clubs in Manhattan. So when I was 6 years old, my dad took me to the Westchester Premier Theater to see Frank, and I went backstage, and Frank looks at me, he goes, hey, kid, whatever you do, don't turn out like your old man. He slipped a C note in my pocket, and I was six, and that was the first time I saw old Blue Eyes face to face. So I was indoctrinated young as Frank, but I wasn't, like, per se, like a big, you know, like obsessed with Frank. But the play is what kind of, like, got me interested in this particular story, because, you know, you're trying to tell a story of a man who's kind of an iconic figure with so many stories you can tell, and so many people know him so many different ways. And the play basically focused on the downturn of his career, and when he basically was washed up in Hollywood, washed up as a singer, and things kept him going was his love for Ava Gardner and his obsession with getting the role of Angelo Maggio in From Here to Eternity. So the play really, really captured me, because I thought, what a great way to tell a story of a man like this by talking about him as an underdog and showing how he overcame obstacles. So that's kind of where I came from.
Yeah, I really loved in the third act of the film how that moment when he wins the Oscar, I thought you handled that really well. And not to give too many spoilers, but probably a lot of you that know history know that was his comeback. It's interesting. My wife and I were talking about it, watching it. And, you know, he still had that relationship going back to his first wife, Nancy, and you show him going back to, you know, have an Italian meal with her, I think, right before the Oscars. And she lived to be over 100. And, you know, she was speculating about what would have been like if she would have stayed with Nancy and the family. It might have been more stable. But yet you show that Ava was such a part of his destiny and such a part in, you know, his comeback and getting that role of Maggio. And his second half of his career might have been different had he not had her, you know, kind of kicking his butt, said, hey, let's get you this part.
Well, it's, it's just great, interesting you said that, Richard, because Ava was in a way his muse, and I guess I guess a one-liner for this movie is that in breaking a man, Ava made the man. So because before Ava, Frank was the skinny Bobby Soxer with all these women swooning over him and singing mm-hmm. all those songs. And when he met Ava, he found someone that he couldn't own, couldn't possess. And she basically, he broke his heart. And if you hear this, and that song you played earlier, I'm a Fool to Want You, and countless other songs that Nelson Riddle produced, basically those songs were songs of heartbreak and loss. And those were all recorded right around the time Frank was dealing with these problems with Ava. And in fact, that particular song is really magical that you brought it up. The night he recorded that, Ava had left him for like the 10th time, and he went to an apartment, and he overdosed. He took a bunch of pills, and they had the musicians in the studio recording. And they're supposed to get Frank to come sing his lay down his track, and they found Frank passed out, and they got him together, and brought him into the studio, gave him a few cups of coffee, and basically he did it in one take, and then went back and slept it off. So that song, the recording of that song is actually the one take that Frank did. The night he tried to commit suicide, and they discovered him passed out on the floor, and revived him and brought him into the studio because they couldn't cancel the session because then the rumors of his emotional instability and problems would really spread and he would never get another gig. So and all the songs of heartbreak are it's so much more palpable when you the pain because of his experience with Ava and his. You know, the gravitas that being with a woman like that and getting her and losing her and eventually, you know, losing her did to him. So she basically made him by breaking him.
And wow, so that is so profound, Rico. And I know many of us and many of you listening have been in that type of relationship where the sexual passion was so strong and yet it could have that self-destructive side to it. Well, you really captured this. What's the best way for our listeners to watch this film? I know I've seen it on Amazon, you know, where you can, I guess, stream or download it, but also we bought a DVD. I think it was through Walmart. But where do you steer people is the best place to get the film?
Well, you can watch it, like you said, on Amazon Prime, iTunes. You could stream it as well. And for those who like seeing it in the theater, we've actually got a request to have an encore screening in Palm Springs, California, where it screened last year for 12 weeks.
Oh, great.
And we're going to do that. And we're going to do a screening in come January. We have requests for Vegas, Hoboken, New Jersey, and Miami. So it'll be screening.
Now, Vegas,
Las Vegas,
Hoboken, and New Jersey?
And New Jersey, yeah, Las Vegas, Miami, and Hoboken, New Jersey, in addition to Palm Springs. So come January, you'll be able to see it in those places if you want
wonderful.
To see it in the theater. Yeah.
And what's the website where the screenings, where they can find all the locations on all that?
It's frankandavamovie.com. That's where you can find it.
Okay, frankandavamovie.com. And Hoboken, of course, as many of you know, frankandavamovie.com.
frankandavathemovie.com.
frankandavathemovie.com. Hoboken, as many of you know, is Frank's hometown. Our daughter is in New Jersey as we speak. Maybe she and her fiance can go to that one. Miami, Vegas, and Palm Springs. And you shot some of your footage there, didn't you, at Frank's Palm Springs house?
We did. Like I said, there was a lot of serendipity, synchronicity and luck in getting this and making this movie. And one of the locations was Frank Sinatra's the Twin Palms Estate in Palm Springs with the piano-shaped pool and it was basically it's furnished as it was in 1950 when Frank lived there. So we basically had a fully dressed and decorated house, and there's a great scene of Ava swimming in the piano shaped pool, wanting to play with Frank, and Frank is standing at the pool reading From Here to Eternity, and she's annoyed with him, like, put the goddamn book down, Frank.
Yeah. It's, you know, your focus when you can, you know, ignore a beautiful woman like that, you know, coming up in her birthday suit, you know, and you're still looking at the novel. I remember reading that novel, and it was a long novel. Well, at least my copy was over 1,000 pages. By the way, my father's favorite film was From Here to Eternity. It's one of my favorites also. And I just really love this film. It really captured that journey. And we have people wanting to send in questions. You can send them into richardrossilive@gmail.com or call the number on your screen, 347-637-2379. We had some landline phone problems. I'm a little nervous at the moment because normally we do this through a real solid, rock-solid landline, and I'm doing it through my cell due to some phone issues here. But I think we'll be fine. Rika, we'll be right back with you and see what questions are coming in here, okay?
Sounds great.
Okay, and here's the song that Rika was describing as we check your questions. I'm a fool to want you, and I tell you, you musicians out there can, even non-musicians can feel the heartbreak. As Rika said, he tried to kill himself after recording this song about his passionate love for Ava Gardner.
Such a fool to hold you, to see your kiss, not mine alone, to share a kiss the devil has.
Gee, I don't mean to bother you, Doc, but it's a mystery to me why it took so long to get this show on the air. It certainly ties up all the loose ends with Christian talk. Gee, my wife just loves this show, Doc.
Well, Peter Falk, one of Frank's buddies, and that's Frank on the song. Let's turn down this old record, As Much As I Love It, from the Capitol years, and get back here with Rika. We have a question coming in from a young filmmaker here, and let's see what he's asking. Alan, a young filmmaker here in La Habra, said he's working on a period piece film, and some of his film school mentors said it's very, very difficult to do a period piece on a low-budget independent situation, and recommended he do something contemporary, but he really wants to do a period piece film in the 70s, kind of the hippie era. And he wondered what advice you gave or how you overcame that, making an independent film, you know, on a independent way, Rico, when the standard wisdom is, gee, you need a studio because you're going to need all these old cars and all these old costumes. I did notice that you did a lot of stuff. I think one of the smart things you did was you shot a lot of stuff a little closer in, so you didn't have to have an epic, you know, cast of thousands of extras, maybe use some stock footage. But how did you deal with that issue? Was that a little daunting or scary, Rico, to do the period piece?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, because like I said, doing a period piece, you know, you can look at those big studio pictures where they will pay one shot one day, it'll cost like a couple $100,000. And with some of the films, that's the entire budget. So what you got to do, you have to be creative. You have to realize that just because the price tag may say $1,000 a day, you know, there's lots of ways you can get it for cheaper. I give you a couple of the sides, like my, I love shopping in antique stores. So you can probably buy antiques a lot cheaper than it costs to rent them from place. So you just got to go to these antique stores in Orange County. There's lots of for old furniture, like the TV set. I found that at some place in the city of Orange, so like very inexpensive. And the cars, three words, Bob's Big Boy. Because every Saturday and Sunday in L.A., Bob's Big Boys, all the car collectors come out and they show their cars. And a lot of guys would love to have their car in the film, and you know, just promise to take care of them or let them be in the shot, like sitting in the car as a chauffeur or being someone in traffic. So and all you really need is two or three cars and an empty street to kind of sell it and find a house that fits the era. And like you said, doing some close-ups and tight shots kind of help you. And where you really want to, you know, spend your money on is the wardrobe, because, you know, if the wardrobe is period and make hair and makeup is period, then people will buy it. You know, that's the thing. So yes,
you look great. Yeah, you look great wardrobe wise with the hat and the look and everything, Rico.
Oh, thank you, Richard. Thank you. Yeah.
And then you were in a period car when you and Ava in the film have a little joyride, had a little bit to drink. You end up in the jail of Sheriff Lloyd, who was played by the legendary Harry Dean Stanton, iconic actor and singer. And this was his last film, or was it his last or second to last? Or
it was his last. He had done it. So he shot with us, and then he did a film called Mr. Lucky that he shot in Arizona in like 7 days.
Mm.
And then he came back and did some pickup shots with us. You could probably tell where the pickup shots were, because in between he was hospitalized. He was a gamer, because he when we had to do the pickup shots, Harry, you need to do, guys I've never seen with you, to kind of tie in the button, what you did at the beginning of the movie. And he's like, I don't need to get dressed, do I? And I'm like, no, it's fine. So he basically showed up on set in a bathrobe.
I remember that. Yeah, I love Rico in the third act, how you come back to him and he's watching the Frank win the Oscar on the TV set that Frank gave him. And that was great. It was such a nice touch.
So Harry was terrific. I mean, Harry is the consummate professional. He lived to be 93, you know, but he was great. And he would sit there and kind of like you'd be rehearsing with him, and you'd think you'd need cue cards. And then the next thing you know, he's like reciting it like Shakespeare. He's right on the mark. So he was terrific. He was terrific.
Yeah, and Eric Roberts was great as Harry Cohn, and he's, as many of the filmmakers listening know, very, very prolific actor. I thought my friend, the late Rance Howard, had a long IMDb to scroll through with a couple hundred, but I think Eric's probably about 400 or so credits.
Hey, Eric's great. Eric loves to work, and he loves to support indie films. Andy Fair did a whole spread on him on the hardest working actor in Hollywood, you know, because he's worked on everything from Dark Knight to smaller projects, to films in Russia, to films with Paul Thomas Anderson. So he likes to work. He's a consummate actor, and he was great. He was, as a matter of fact, we were in Italy at the time. And Eric was in Italy working on an Italian TV show. And so I basically flew over there, and he took on his days off. He shot with us for Frank and Ava. So that's how we got to have him in Italy and have that Italian backdrop. So he's a marvelous person and a great, wonderful actor and a great mentor.
Well, you had to wear a lot of hats on this, co-writing it, producing it, playing the lead. Was it ever hard playing your part? Like, did you ever feel rushed because you were doing so many other things? And did you have to kind of remind yourself to give yourself the time you needed to do the takes and everything? And or did you feel like sometimes you were rushing your stuff and you know, giving everyone else the multiple takes because you had to attend to producing matters? Or were you able to take, or were you like Frank, a one-take guy? Maybe you were more like Frank and you didn't need a lot of takes. They always called Frank the one-take wonder.
One take wonder, exactly. Well, I tell you, you know, it kind of evolved into that. I mean, first of all, to have a cast that I was surrounded by, you know, and starting with the beautiful and wonderful Emily Alicia Lowe playing Ava Gardner.
Very lovely actress.
Lovely actress. And going from her to Harry Dean, to Eric, to Richard Portnow, Miano, Jonathan Silverman, Dominic Lombardozzi, who was just in The Irishman, Johnny Williams. I mean, going down that entire cast, when you have a cast like that around you, you know, it's like when you're playing basketball with a good team, it's kind of hard not to get the layups because they're right there. They're right there for you. So that made it great. But in terms of wearing the hats, you know, the movie is about Frank at a time where he was, you know, being harassed by the press, harassed by, you know, by gossip columnists, but harassed by his wife, dealing with the fact that if he was trying to get his career back. So so the reality of being on the set, being harassed by craft services, and so-and-so needs a parking spot, and so-and-so has to be out in 2 minutes. So what you do as an actor, you let that stuff kind of wash into you, because that comes across on screens. So one of the lessons as an actor, you want to use what's happening in the moment. And in the moment, the more chaos that was happening on set, the more Frank was really kind of trying to keep it together, because in the story, Frank was trying to keep it together. Everybody was worried about him cracking, and he had all these pressures going on. And I think some of the best scenes were done with only one take, because we had, chaos and things going on offset. And by the time he got to me, it was like one take, and the director was like, "Good, this is great, we got that." And I'd be like, "Are you sure?" He goes, "Oh yeah. Where do you see yourself?" And some of the, I won't give them away, but some of the best scenes were done in just one take, because I was dealing with so many other things.
Wow, that's a lot like Frank's song that we were talking about, the "I'm a Fool to Want You" in the one take, because he was, the passion, the heartbreak was there. Interesting, very, very interesting stuff. Andrew in Encino had a question about Sinatra's alleged mob connections and commenting on that. I want to say that I really liked how you handled that, and some of the great actors you had, Robert Costanzo. You and I, Rico, are both Italian, East Coast, and my surname's the most common last name in Italy. One of the things I really liked about your film was, we all have ethnic stereotypes, of our ethnicity. And quite frankly, I grew up with a lot of those guys, being surrogate father figures and uncles and La Costa Nostra guys. But the thing is, a lot of these guys were very loving to me as a little boy and looked out for me and loved their family. And they weren't like Darth Vader, all bad, even though they did some bad things sometimes to make money. And I like that you showed that in your film, Rico, that these, the godfather, I think it was Willie, if I remember, to Sinatra, that a lot of these people really did love him, look out for him. In fact, they were concerned about him, making sure he stood by his family and didn't completely abandon his family out of his, lust for Ava. And I think you showed the nuance of those Italian type of men that you and I both grew up around.
Yeah, well, that came from reality. I grew up in Brooklyn, and my dad hung out with guys like that. My dad was in the restaurant nightclub business. So, and to me, all these guys are like nice Italian men, older men. They would always Christmas time. They give you put money in your pocket or ask if you were doing good in school. And they were family men. But the job they did was something obviously wasn't something very family, but they were, basically they were nice guys, and that's who I met, and that's what I experienced, and I tried to keep that real as possible, because that's really how it was. I mean, Willie Moretti was Frank's godfather; he looked out for him, and all those guys kind of looked out for Frank. I deal with the three theories of how Frank got the part and from his eternity. And of course, the whole horse's head story that was in The Godfather, that's probably not what happened. But I kind of lay it out there with the three different possibilities. And in fact, there's a baseball game that's critical to Frank. And that we couldn't actually show in the movie because of, the licensing for that clip would have cost too much. But Bobby Thompson's home run that beat the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 51 pennant, you hear the guys talking about it, and then you hear Willie say, "Bet the Dodgers." So Willie Moretti was Frank's godfather, his goomba that was looking out for him. And Moretti, if anyone, would have been the one to try to approach the studio to try to get Frank the part. Except Moretti was also a big gambler, okay? And so Moretti made a huge bet, say over $100,000, on the Dodgers. He also happened a few weeks after he appeared on television in front of the Kefauver Committee. where all the other mob guys who went on TV were all instructed to just smile and say, I take the fifth, you know, or quote it, I refuse to answer questions. And Moretti instead used that as a forum to make jokes and have fun with the senator and kind of, he didn't really give up any information, but he basically didn't sit there and follow the instructions by just saying, I take the fifth. So he kind of ticked off a few guys that doing that. And then he lost a whole bunch of money when Bobby Thompson hit the home run. And so he got whacked. And part of it was because they thought he was a loose lip, and then part of it because he owed all this money. So when William Moretti gets killed, Frank actually loses the one powerful ally who could potentially go to Harry Cohn and say, hey, this is, Frank's got to get this part. So more than likely, it was not the mob that got him the part. And more than likely, it had more to do with maybe Ava. So, and some other issues too. So when you watch the movie, you get to see that.
Yes. A good scene with Ava and Harry Cohn there. And, you know, it kind of ends with a hint that maybe he wanted her to do a favor for him, and you don't quite show it. But, I think, as you said, she was so influential in making this man. The play was really got Frank in you. So, you know, you brought all that work on the play into this part. So it's probably very interesting as an actor to do a role where it's not just you get the script, you're showing up a week later on set, but this is something you lived with for, I don't know, maybe like 5-6 years at least. You had all that in you to finally do the film. Do you think that, like, the delay in doing the film several years after the play, that it worked to your advantage because you live with this so long that it was like you brought so much more to it?
Yeah, I think it did. I remember when I first got cast in the play, was developed at the Actors Studio out here in L.A., and the playwright, Will Manis, wrote it as a one-act, and he called me up and said, Rico, I wrote this one-act play about Sinatra, and I want you to, you know, we're going to do a reading at the studio, and I want you to read Frank. So I went down there and we read this one act play. I read Frank, another actress read Ava, and they asked around the studio. They said, so what do you think? And people chime in, they raise their hands, and one woman raised her hand and said, "What kind of story is this about two people who are just drinking and having sex and drinking again and smoking? What kind of marriage is that?" and then somebody else raised their hand and said, "Well, honestly, you haven't been married to the right guy yet."
haven't been married to the right guy yet.
That's what he told her. So everyone broke up the house, and then the play was further developed, and we did it for, we performed it for 6 months, and people would ask me, well, how can you play an iconic figure like Frank Sinatra? And I say, well, I don't look at him as an iconic figure, because if you try to look at him as this figure, this person that's out someplace outside of you, there's no way you're going to play it. I said, well, here's how I approach Frank. You know, Frank was a blue-eyed, you know, 5'8" Italian guy from Jersey, hung out, chased women, hung out in nightclubs, smoked cigarettes, was quick-witted, you know. And I said, you know what? If my dad could sing, he'd be Sinatra. My dad was that kind of, my dad was a blue-eyed, short guy, and hung out with mob guys and smoked cigarettes and drank whiskey and chased women, much to my, you know, mother's disappointment, but that was his world. So the spine of it was a guy like my dad who's comfortable and also, you know, Frank never took no for an answer. He tried to go for it. My father was a guy who never took no for an answer. So I was like sparring, and then fold in impossible love, which, you know, who of us have not been in that situation where we have to have somebody that we feel it in our bones that that person's not there. There's just that space just can't be filled, and the emptiness of that. So you fold that into it, and then the research I did to write the screenplay, reading, you know, every article and magazine and paper and novel, try to, it kind of reinforced, you know, and gave me a perspective of how that person confronted these situations, you know. So therefore, when we came time to do the movie, you know, to me it was more grounded, you know, and what was at stake, and the fear he had and the fear he would show, because that's kind of like how these guys were, guys like my dad and those in that era. You know, you had fear, sure you had trepidation, sure you had insecurity, but you didn't show, because that's kind of it's the street rules. If you show it, then you're weak. But then Frank would show it in his drinking, in his suicide attempts, and then totally lose it for Ava. So that was the one time he showed vulnerability, was when it came to her. So it came out. So to the time I spent between the play and the film, reading more about it, just reading about more and more situations, realizing, you know, the stories that this, the end he went to try to gain her love, and the multiple suicide attempts, for example, there's a story where originally Frank was cast as a Music Man, and so Shirley Jones, who's Marty Engel's wife, and Shirley actually there'll be eventually a B-reel where we had this interview. I interviewed Shirley Jones and lots of people who witnessed Frank and Ava from back then. So Shirley tells a story how they had shot The Music Man with Frank. They spent 6 months recording the music, choreographing the dances, the numbers, and then they had to go to Maine to shoot the acting scenes. And the first day of shooting, Frank shows up late, comes out of his car, looks around, sees two cameras, and says, "Why do you have two cameras for?" And the director said, "Well, no, Frank, there's this new thing called CinemaScope. So we're going to shoot one camera the regular way and one with this new CinemaScope camera. But don't worry about it. It's just going to be there in the background. You have to not do any extra takes." And he said, "Well, I signed on to one movie, not two." And he got in the car, drove away, and quit the film. Basically throwing away 6 weeks of choreography, song recording, prep. And people were dumbfounded. Oh, how can he do this? They were upset at him. And Shirley Jones was like, you know, eventually she found Gordon McCready, who came and did the part after he lost some weight. But the real story was that Shirley found out that Ava was in Africa doing Magamba with Clark Gable, whom Frank was extremely jealous of, because Ava, you know, had a reputation for, you know, loving these, her leading men, you know, everyone from Burke Lancaster to Robert Mitchum. And so they had an argument on the phone, and Ava basically said, "Why don't you have fun with Shirley? I guess, you know, and have fun with that one. And I guess I'll have to occupy myself here in Africa," or some words to that effect, and hung up on him. And Frank went crazy, quit the film, got on the plane, flew to Africa so he could be on set to make sure Ava wouldn't stray. So that's how obsessed he was with her. So that, I mean, that's the end of it. So that's the kind of obsession he had with this woman, that he had to have her, had to be around her. He was afraid of leaving her alone for even a day, because, you know, she may have interest in somebody else. So that's how much she was.
The copy we have of the film, Rico, you have, I don't know if it's on all the copies in the screenings, but the copy we have has Shirley talking for a moment about towards the end credits about Frank and saying that he, you know, wanted to control Ava and she would not allow herself to be controlled. And it was, really nice that you had her, and also our friend Terry Moore. We were pleasantly surprised to see her. We had actually were just talking with her at an awards thing recently. And I thought that was really nice at the end, how you have some of those people that were stars that witnessed a lot of this, you know, talking for a moment towards the end of the film.
Yeah. That was a fun part too, talking to these people and hearing, you know, what it was like being around those people and hearing like the real stories, you know, not just a gossip or not just something that's been like watered down and translated and written in some biography. So this was, so that's what's so great about having the real life accounts and seeing. It was a crazy romance. It really was.
It really, really was. Well, we'll just take one more break for program identification and come back with any closing questions or your closing words, Rico. We'll be right back, okay?
Sounds great.
We'll be right back. We'll be right back with all of you here.
Attention! All you radio listeners, I want you to listen. Now, if you're like me, you want a show with spirit. I set your sights on Rich Rossi Live. That's all.
We'll be back in a few seconds with Rico discussing Frank and Ava, the movie. He was a fool to want her, but she was really something, wasn't she? We'll be right back.
And once again, these words I have to say. I'm a fool to want you. Every day I need.
Wow, if that doesn't break your heart. My late father was a jazz guitarist, and he and the other jazz musicians that were real pros, they respected Frank. I mean, he was the musician's singer, jazz singer, and they all respected him. And I was really grateful at the end of my dad's life, I got to take him to see Frank perform live. Frank was then in his 80s and reading some of the lyrics off the teleprompter and everything, but it really was something for my father and I to see him one last time. You know, I guess, Rico, in a way, it's kind of interesting as much of a hard party in life that he led and the suicide attempts and the drinking and the smoking. He had great longevity when you think about the way he lived, you know.
Well, yeah, he lived to be 82 years old, yeah, which mm-hmm. for a guy that lived hard, yeah. I mean, the funny thing is my dad passed at 81, mm-hmm. 81 and a half. And actually it was when he passed and I basically, that was the impetus to say, okay, now I have to make this movie.
Wow.
And so you see the movie's dedicated to Mike the Waiter. That was my dad's nickname.
Oh,
that's
wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure he's very, very proud of you, Rico, from that cloud of heavenly witnesses. I think it's a great tribute to your dad. And to old Blue Eyes. Speaking of Blue Eyes, I don't know if I'm allowed to ask this because it's kind of like asking a magician their secrets, but there was an opening shot of you with the eyes. They kind of morph and become bluer and bluer. I was wondering how you did that, if you had blue contacts or if it was like one of those post-production Keller corrections or if you'd rather not say. But you know that shot where your eyes just seem to get bluer and bluer on the close-up?
Well, you know, like you said, movie magic, we can't give up our secrets, you know. but yes, that's a pickup. Yeah.
It's a great shot. It's a great shot. So, all of you listening, the website is Frank and Ava, AVA, themovie.com. Some upcoming in person screenings at the aptly chosen locations of Vegas, which of course was a place that Frank was a big performer in Vegas, and the mob of course was a big part of making Vegas what it was. Hoboken, his hometown, Miami, and Palm Springs, where Frank had one of his homes. Well, Rico, I want to give you the last words. Anything you want to say about how people can keep up with this film or with you?
Yeah, you can keep up by going to the website, or you can follow us on Instagram, Frank and Ava the Movie on Instagram. And also we have a Twitter at Frank and Ava 2017. So that's all. So you can follow us that way. But just to say, it was, you know, people say, you know, what's it like making an independent film? And I say, well, it's a Herculean effort with a Promethean payoff, but it's all worth it. It's all worth it, and you know, and you have to shout out to my director Mike Lobowitz, Misha Siegel, who worked on the music, Donald Barrett, who worked on the music, Andy Ross was my music supervisor. He also worked on Whiplash, and the cast is just, like I said, was amazing. Megan Foley was my casting director. She found me so many wonderful actors being this in this film. And and like I said, everyone that made this possible, it was like it's basically luck, but perseverance. You know, you don't take no for an answer. You know, you have to find a way. And in much in the way that Frank had to have the part of Maggio, I had to make this movie. So that it was the same kind of persistence and perseverance and not taking no that got this movie made. So that's kind of how when art and life kind of merge. So that's the way you should approach any independent film. You can't take no for an answer. Just go for it and realize that goal.
Yes. You're a real example of that, because you and I living here in Los Angeles, it seems like 90% of the people, the person serving you coffee or the person you meet working in on your car, everyone has a script and wants to make a movie, but so many lack that follow through, that work ethic, that perseverance, that persistence to really do it. And, you know, I really respect you for having that, Rico, because this was quite an accomplishment, a very courageous accomplishment, as you said, to take on someone that most view as iconic, and knowing that, you know, people are going to, you know, some people will be, oh, you shouldn't even touch that kind of a mindset or critical in that sense. But I like what you said about seeing the humanity of him. And I think that's one reason a lot of us were really interested in this film, is the humanity of that passionate love. And, you know, there's so many poems and songs about how love can be, you know, the old song when I was a kid in the 70s, Love Hurts. I mean, this, you really show how this, I like that you kind of zeroed in on this period too, because you could have done a, you know, as my grandpa used to say, throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall and some of it will stick. You could have done like this huge, biography through his whole life. But I think it was really, really great that you focused in on this period that I don't think anyone else has really done a film about, which is just the Frank and Ava. I mean, you have flashbacks to the childhood and things like that of a moment or two. But for the most part, I really like how you focused in on that period.
Well, thank you, Richard. Thanks for having me on. And like I said, if you read the dedication and the memoriam, you know, that's it kind of shows like all the people who are instrumental who are not around to actually see the finished product. And starting with my dad and Marty Ingalls and Elaine Macaluso, who was my original music supervisor, helped write some of the original songs that are in the movie.
Mm.
Like I said, Harry Dean, Penny Marshall, who was always a fan of my making a film, and she's always supportive and gave advice. Catherine Hellman, she has a great scene in the movie. And like I said, lots of people who are just supportive and who kind of really, tell us, go forward. Don't take no. And they helped out. So you got to really remember those people, because they really helped, make it possible. And people like, if you watch the film at the end, during the credits, Keaton Simons gives us an original song. Dionne Warwick sings a song. She loved Frank. She shares a birthday with Frank. Frank used to call her his daughter because she had the same birthday.
Which is tomorrow, by the way, right? Happy birthday tomorrow to Frank and Dionne.
And Dionne, exactly. Happy birthday to Sinatra, exactly. And Dionne came on and sang a song in one take on camera. It's in the movie. And
wow, that was great.
And she had a great line, because we did the take, we recorded the song, and I was happy. But of course, you know, the director and the music engineer went up to her and said, "Ms. Dionne, we love that. Can we have one more for safety?" And she looked at him and said, "Child, I don't do anything for safety. Just like Frank, I'm one chief."
Oh, love it. Well, I tell you, that one take was gold. I loved it. I really enjoyed it. She has one of the finest voices in popular music, and that was really nice touch. And it had a feel, a Frankish feel to it, as did some of the other songs in the film that weren't Frank, but you'd swear they were a Frank song that you didn't know, because a lot of the music had that style and that genre to it.
Yeah, yeah, and we found a guy named Luca Ellis, who sings and sounds just like Frank, and you hear him singing some originals that Lane Like a Loser wrote. And if you close your eyes on some of the songs, you think you're hearing old Blue Eyes.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of great finds, a lot of great people we got to meet. Blessed to have the opportunity to meet these kinds of people who believed in the vision, believed in the project. It wasn't really about, hey, how much am I getting paid? It was about, hey, I want to do this film, you know, because it's a great story and the script is compelling. And we want to tell this together, you know, and it became like a collaboration. And that's kind of what you want to do. You want to inspire people with your vision so people want to jump on board. I mean, I got to a point where I remember that people would come up to me at the gym and say, hey, I heard you're doing this Sinatra movie. I go, yeah, well, it's really low budget. So he goes, where's my part? I'm like, well, I really can't afford your quote. I need my money. I want to be in your movie. Put me in your movie. And these are, I don't tell you who it is, but a very well-known actor who's done movies with, you know, Woody Allen, Steven Spielberg, and he heard about the project and wanted to be part of it because he heard great things and he believed in the story. So as a filmmaker, you want to inspire people to kind of go outside the box and to really, you know, bring their gifts to the table. And that's really what it's about. And by doing that, by making that film, that inspires people who watch the film. Hey, you can do this too. Or, hey, you know, and the story is about dreams and realizing dreams and overcoming obstacles. So that's why I kind of thought that, like I said, life and art all came together, all the wonderful people that came around us to help us make the film.
Well, congratulations. And I'm glad you're doing some live screening events. Will you and some people from the cast or be at these live events?
Yeah, we'll try to definitely Vegas and Palm Springs and definitely Hoboken, and if hurricanes don't kick up early this year, we'll make our way down to Miami as well.
Okay, great, Rico. Well, thanks for coming on. God bless you, and I'm really proud of you and your accomplishment. It's really awesome.
Thank you so much. God bless you too. And bless everyone that's listening. And thank you all for watching the movie. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're most welcome. It was our pleasure. And thank you everybody for listening. And as Rico said, God bless each and every one of you. And Frank and Ava, the movie.com. We'll look forward to being with you next time at Richard Rossi Live.